This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's a hard fact of life that life can be hard. That might sound like bad news, but the good news is that therapy works, and BetterHelp can help you find a therapist to do what you need to do to stay on track. Therapy is whatever you want it to be. Maybe you're not feeling motivated right now and like some tools to help, or maybe you're feeling insecure in relationships or at work. Whatever you need, BetterHelp can help. I use therapy from time to time to help me sort through challenges, emotions, or just to ensure that I'm on track for the things that are important. BetterHelp is customized online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist. It's much more affordable than in-person therapy, and you can start communicating with your therapist in under 24 hours. Join the millions of people who are seeing what online therapy is really about. And special offer to Man God Law listeners, you can get 10% off your first month of professional therapy at BetterHelp.com/ManGodLaw. That's better, HELP.com/ManGodLaw. Thanks again to BetterHelp for sponsoring this episode.
Dylan was a revolutionary, man. The way that Elvis freed your body, Bob freed your mind.
This is Bob Dylan, about man and God and law.
They're selling postcards of the hanging. They're painting the passports brown. The beauty parlor is filled with sailors. The circus is in town. Here comes the blind commissioner. They've got him in a trance. One hand is tied to the tightrope walker. The other is in his pants. And the riot squad, they're restless. They need somewhere to go. As Lady and I look out tonight from Desolation Row.
Music is magic, and magic is music. And one of the tough calls that any music fan needs to make is how much to analyze the work of our favorite artists and how much to simply enjoy it. Though I had read Rolling Stone and Spin and everything written about Jim Morrison when I was a kid, it wasn't until I was in my early 30s and found Greil Marcus's Invisible Republic that I caught the bug of Dylan books. We'll be doing an episode on the top 10 Dylan books later in this season. For me, what started as a dribble with that first book by Greil Marcus, who is to this day my most obvious and formative influence as a writer about music, well, that drip and dribble eventually became a hailstorm of books about Dylan and just about everybody else. With the explosion of Dylan studies and Dylanologists all over Twitter, and now the blowout opening of the Bob Dylan Center in Tulsa, Oklahoma, which I missed, it's easy to get FOMO about all that's swirling in the Dylan universe. What have I missed? Who heard what I said? Is there something in what I'm hearing or saying or thinking that's going to add something of use to this conversation? Or am I just distracting myself and the occasional other from what this music is for? Listening. Our guest this episode is Scott Wormuth. And if there's anyone who has plunged into the art of decoding how Dylan works and what that way of working means, it is Scott. This is how the sausage is made, the sausage of the songs, particularly in the later stages of Dylan's life as a composer. And if you're not one to want to see what happens when they make the sausage or what happens behind the curtain of your favorite magician musician, beware. Scott's been reshaping how we hear Dylan for well over a decade. He's a master listener and thinker who has changed the way I hear Dylan. So get ready. Here goes nothing. And speaking of nothing, nothing Dylan does is unoriginal. And that's because there is no original. Let's put these things in our pipes and smoke them, shall we? This conversation will take you for a ride. I'm Stephen Daniel Arnoff, host of the podcast Bob Dylan About Man and God and Law, and author of the book about man and God and law, The Spiritual Wisdom of Bob Dylan. That book is available wherever fine books are sold. Cut up, copied whole cloth, plagiarized, or disappeared into something else. Yes, indeed. Welcome to episode 4 of season 3, Bob Dylan's Memory Revisited with Scott Wormuth.
But let me tell you, Scott, I may speak for some of the universe of fans of Bob Dylan and really music in general. When I first encountered your work, I didn't want to believe it. I didn't want to believe it because despite the fact that I've done a lot of work myself on what's called the art of memory and the ways that we think of originality today, creativity today as being the new thing. In fact, for much of the human history, it's been about how we piece together pieces of puzzles in new and interesting ways. There's not too much that's actually invented.
You write about the notion of invention and the ties to inventory, the pieces that you'd need to put that together and those ties, which I thought was a really good point in your book.
Oh, thank you. So for my own edification and for those who are listening in, would you be willing to do the 101 seminar? The Scott Wormuth intro to your methodology, how you got to it, how you have envisioned a way of seeing and hearing Dylan's work in what I have to say, and I'll probably say this a couple times, an incredibly important, interesting, insightful way that, you know, at the end of the day, frankly, it may be the most important thing that we can say about Dylan in certain ways is in a sense what you've come up with. So help us get into it, and we'll see what we can do.
Sure. I appreciate the kind words. Yeah. For me, the work that I'm doing now really mostly stemmed, the big spark for that was the release of Love and Theft in 2001, which I really became just very focused on. I didn't anticipate that it would do that. I bought the record in a big box store on a whim when it came out. I saw it there and I said, oh, a new album from Bob Dylan. I hadn't listened to a new album from Bob Dylan in a long time. And I was just struck by the language and the music in that. And it really brought me back into looking at his work, where I might have pulled away by the tail end of the 80s. I spent a lot of time in my teens, like any fan of, you know, American popular music, rock and roll music, really listening to a lot of his work, especially my late teens, early college years, just going through all of those records and going through the lyrics and thinking about how do you write songs like that, and just the notion of that, and being touched by those songs in the many different ways that they are. I mean, that's a really, really common experience. That's why Bob Dylan is so popular. And, you know, I bought the copy of the lyrics and drawings book, the one that's got the orange and gray cover. It's not, sure, it came out in the 80s. Not a particularly attractive cover, but it's, right. I remember just sitting there with that book in front of me going, wow, how am I going to get into this? I mean, there's so much there, songs I hadn't heard yet. You know, mid 80s was kind of a rough time to be a fan of Dylan's work, in that there wasn't a lot of material coming out that was engaging me. Empire Burlesque came out when I was about 18 or so, and I was hoping, oh boy, a new album from Bob Dylan, but those songs and the production styles of the 80s weren't working for me. And then Down in the Groove wasn't clicking for me, and I kind of pulled away. And so once Love and Theft came out, then I just had to do a lot of backtracking and a lot of building out for that. I'm kind of a musicologist by instinct, by nature, huge music fan since I'm a little kid. I've been playing guitar since I'm 8, writing music, listening to music, working as a disc jockey. I had my own weekly radio show in high school when I was 15, and just dive into deep into whatever it's going to be. And I was a huge Beatles fan, or the Beach Boys, or big blues fan, rock and roll fan, spent tons of time with oh, there's the Chess Records catalog. Here's a couple of Chuck Berry songs, and always Bo Diddley, and there's Muddy Waters, and there's Howlin' Wolf, and there's Little Walter. And then you can spend years there. The same with, you know, I like Elvis Presley. Some of my first records were 45s for my mom. So, you know, Hound Dog and Don't Be Cruel, Blue Suede Shoes and Tutti Frutti, 45s. Like, oh, this is got a spark to it. I remember sitting with my pile of 45s my mom gave me at 7 or 8. It's like her box of 45s from when she was a teenager, going, okay, this is the pile that I'm going to go and listen to again. Here's the Everly Brothers. Here's Buddy Holly. Here's Elvis here. And, you know, Mr. Blue by the Fleetwoods, maybe not so much, or here's Novelty Records. Here's 16 Tons or here. And my dad worked in the late 60s, early 70s in a record pressing plant. And one of the job perks was you get to bring home free records. So that really was a wide range of stuff besides what they might listen to that left a huge amount of music available for me to dive into, having a fairly decent sized record library. And
so you were one of the reasons completely steeped in music. So you're as long as you can remember, really, you've just been a music person all the way through.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I've got, and that delved into record collecting. And I mostly because I grew up in an analog world. To hear the music, you had to have a copy of it. And so I've got, you know, like probably 4,000 or 5,000 LPs in my record library. And I worked in radio for years. I was music director in a bunch of different radio stations. The job perk there is you get free music, more music than you can ever possibly listen to. But here it is, and more streams of music for that. So, I was a music minor in college. I was a liberal arts major. You know, my other focuses were archaeology, sociology, and psychology. So what are you going to, like this, the work I'm doing now with looking at Dylan's, not only the lyrics and the music, but also the text. And this, because the periods of the stuff I'm really focused on that I find the most interesting it's really a kind of archaeology to it. Looking at the text of Chronicles, Volume 1, Love and Theft. And one thing that I think is really overlooked a lot is the script for Masked and Anonymous, which are all about the same time frame. And it was really quite a role for, you know, Love and Theft is just such a spectacular record. And then that's 2001, 2004, I guess, is when Chronicles comes out. And I read that. And then the film came out, and I saw that in the theater in up the block in my neighborhood. There's one other person in the theater when I saw Masked and Anonymous. And then to get the script for that and to start.
It was probably Dylan. It was probably Dylan.
Albert Drake is an interesting town, but with Love and Theft, there's so much going on in the language there, and that pieces would bubble up and people would talk about, and that musically, this is coming from this place. This is the roots for this component. This line is from F. Scott Fitzgerald. This is whatever those pieces are going to be. One of the bigger sparks for me, besides listening to Love and Theft and just being totally there and having to backtrack, I hadn't heard the records that came out before that. So I had to go and listen to Time Out of Mind. And then there's the entire world of live recordings and downloading so much of the Neverending Tour recordings and finding where what's in Dylan's inventory, all of the folk songs that he's going to be covering and the CDs and releases of that, just collecting him playing trad songs live and what are the ones he's picking and going through that. But there was that story about Confessions of a Yakuza and Dylan using lines for that. It was a guy named Chris Johnson who was teaching English as a second language in Japan and just happened to pick up the book and recognize, wait, that line on the first page I know from that song, and then went through them and found a whole series of other ones. To me, that's you know, like Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, Golden Ticket type stuff. And how can you have that experience? What a experience. So how can you replicate that experience in the lab? You know, and it turns out, well, you can, and you just have to be really diligent. And so spending the time and going through that and seeing how much of Love and Theft is that building of pieces from other sources and how deep that goes in the lyrics and that still pieces are coming up that hadn't been recognized within the past couple of months because it's just so richly interwoven. And it's just a fascinating way to work. I think it's different than what we had seen him do with the work earlier, where it's much more deliberate. I think we can trace the growth of it. one reason some of the stuff I was writing about got noticed because I'd spent a lot of time with Love and Theft and going through that and piecing that together and just keeping notes on that, because it was just a fascinating project. And then the next record, Modern Times, came out, and that leaked online about a week or two before it came out. And I was like visualizing, oh, well, I know what Love and Theft has got, at least parts of it. And here's, I just remember visualizing it as like, here's a field of snow that's not touched. And we haven't had a chance to look at this yet. What are these songs? What are the building blocks for these songs? And I started using just some basic strategies. Though there's a peculiar sounding phrase, let me run that through Google and see what comes up. Basic detective work. You know, that's an odd sounding phrase. And when that happened, I started piecing together on Modern Times. Dylan was using bits from the poetry of Henry Timrod, which I posted on expectingrain.com and the old Dylan pool, saying, hey, take a look at this. There's something going on here. Here's another example. Here's another example. Here's another example. Which was more just like compare and contrast, take a look. When I discuss what Bob Dylan's doing, he's clearly reading this poet, which was just more just a chat room discussions, really. And with that, I was mentioning it to the guy who lived across the street from me at the time. He's a middle school Spanish teacher, big music fan, and we would talk all the time because we're out in the street and we're friends. And I mentioned to him, hey, you know, the new Bob Dylan record's coming out, and take a look at one of the things I've been working on. It looks like I was using these components here. And I guess his middle school teacher background, he wrote a letter to John Perales at the New York Times saying, hey, Bob Dylan should give credit. Bob, he wrote this like almost a little bit of a crank letter to the New York Times. And then the next day, there's an answering machine message from a reporter at the New York Times and calling me to talk about it. And then a few days later, it's on the front page of the New York Times. Yeah. Bob Dylan Rebel was the title for that. And then the day after that, I was on, they asked me to be on All Things Considered on NPR, and I think it was just, it caught it at the right moment. That Modern Times ended up being very successful. It was brand new. And my neighbor took that action. It was just an odd set of circumstances. And following that, within a week or two, there was a writer, a teacher, his name is Edward Cook. And he did a post saying, hey, not only is there stuff going on in these lyrics, but take a look at Chronicles. And he put about four or five different examples of Dylan using material from Chronicles. And for me, that was an eye opener. I'd read Chronicles. I was certainly intrigued by Chronicles, but I hadn't thought about Chronicles being written the same style and the same methods that we were seeing in Love and Theft. And Ed's a really bright guy, Edward Cook. He wrote a book called Solving the Mysteries of the Dead Sea Scrolls. He's one of the editors of Dead Sea Scrolls, a new translation, going through little tiny bits of text and trying to put them in context is his profession. And we spent about 2 years just going back and forth, trading notes, going through Chronicles methodically, page by page, to see what other components we might find. And it's just such a rich book. The book is just so, there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of examples within that. And so just like archaeology, gathering the pottery shards, gathering those bits, building that inventory. I think of it as the notion of a commonplace, and what does Bob Dylan's commonplace look like? Can you build his inventory and figuring out what books is Bob Dylan reading? So you can build a Bob Dylan bookshelf, which I have a Pinterest page called exactly that. It has about 100 different titles where Dylan has almost certainly used material from them in a whole range of ways, in songs, in the movie script, in Chronicles, and mapping those pieces out. And then it's, okay, we've got all of these pottery shards. Do they tell you anything? And trying to keep tabs on those. So, and just keeping notes, like here's all of the Hemingway ones. Here's a document that keeps that. Here's all the ones from Saxe-Rahmer. Here's, well, could it be this one? Well, maybe, maybe not. Well, then let's take a look within that text itself. A lot of it is reading slowly. So reading through a book and noticing, hey, there's a line here. If we go two paragraphs back, that's another one that jumps out. And that's much more likely. Or see how he's, and then you can start to see how is he playing with the language? What is he doing with it? How is he pairing things? There's a lot of intentional pairing of couplets in Love and Theft. There's pairings of voices to create new voices that you hear in Chronicles. So it was really, and you can do that work for quite a long time. The material is so dense, and that ultimately to discover that he's built all of these hidden subtexts throughout, and that they cross over from work to work, and that there's all of this other hidden meaning there, that if you take the time and go very, very slowly and then look at the moving parts, you can start to see some of those pieces there. And I think I was just lucky to find some of them. And I think there's plenty more there that we just haven't even noticed yet or even thought about.
So there's this amazing story of how even any of this thinking came to be. It was just a lucky neighborhood conversation in Albuquerque that brought up on the world this crack that's just opened up. So Dylan's a curator then, okay? So Dylan's a collector, he's a curator. On the one hand, right, someone could say, well, he's a genius, he has a photographic memory, and he is just sitting down at his writing pad or strumming his guitar, and the words are going to come out the same way that if you and I were to sit down at the piano or the guitar, whatever our instrument of choice was, certain melodies would come out. Certain phrases would come out if we had a few drinks in the bar and got up and they were playing the right 12 bar blues, you know, it'd be some combination of Meet Me in the Morning, Blue Suede Shoes, and whatever else happened to creep up because of what someone was wearing at the bar. Right. That's just the way it goes when you've got a photographic memory and you let it out on the one extreme, if we can even call it an extreme, because maybe that's just the way we work. Some people have better memories than others, and other people are freer than others with their memories, but whatever it is, there's something in his system and it comes out. And then on another extreme or another plane, I guess, you've got an artist who has said on many different occasions, whether he talked about his guitar playing or he talked about his songwriting, I can't do now what I used to be able to do subconsciously or automatically, but I've learned these new techniques, right? Almost like I found another crossroads, you know, a legendary crossroads where I learned a technique. I got an elixir and I got a new code I can play. So in that sense, do you imagine Dylan as being the luckiest genius who's just listened to all this great music, read all these great books, seen all these wonderful films, and he's just cranking out these couplets and these phrases that come out? And you know, he did happen to be reading Hemingway on February 13th, 2015, and hence, right, the songs come out. Or is he sitting down with a sort of William Burroughs cut and paste sort of, you know, throwing his books up in the air and saying, well, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to put Hemingway and Blake here. I'm going to put Henry Timrod over here. This is going to be a line that Anthony Quinn said in such and such film over here. And all this together is going to be my new way of writing music. How conscious of it? How disciplined is it? And how do you imagine that room looking? You've described the yep. blanket of snow. What's Dylan's writing world look like in that? Can you parse it? Can you give us an educated guess?
Sure. I think you do have... I don't know that I buy the notion of him having a photographic memory. Some people do, and they can look at a page of text and it's there. I think you mentioned Hemingway, and he certainly quotes Hemingway quite a bit in Chronicles Volume 1. And there's one portion in Chronicles where he's paraphrasing and quoting Hemingway, but he kind of leads towards how to visualize that. He writes, I needed to learn how to telescope things, ideas, things that were too big to see all at once, like all the books in the library, everything laying around on all the tables. You might be able to put it into one paragraph or into one verse of a song if you could get it right. So I think of that notion. He's got a library. He's certainly got a huge library. The books are open on all the different tables. And in the point of that, he's actually quoting Hemingway. Hemingway doesn't say, he just says one paragraph. Dylan adds the one verse of his song. So I think of that notion of telescoping, which is used in a couple of different ways. I worked in radio, and telescoping in radio is taking out all the bits that you don't need and just keeping the interstitials. Here's the intro to the song with the DJ saying, and here's what the DJ says outward. Here's the beginning of the commercial. You can take an hour and telescope it down into, you know, a good 3 minutes and maybe... get a feel for what that sounds like. And I think there's that notion there. There's still the guy that wrote all those Bob Dylan songs. I mean, that catalog, you can't deny. And to keep at it and to keep that balance there, how do you get there? And I think on the Rough and Rowdy Ways, there's those two songs. There's Mother of Muses, and there's My Own Version of You. And I think Mother of Muses might be whatever that's going on in there, his own memory, how is he finding those pieces? And that's, you know, whatever that touches him and that genius that comes out. And then My Own Version of You is a song about Frankensteining and how do you piece these things together? And that notion of, I think of to be able to do that effectively, to gather all those bits and put them together, the notion of the commonplace and what is Bob Dylan's commonplace book look like? And there's probably a range of different answers over the decades for that. We've got his working notebooks that you can see. There's the ones they have in Tulsa that from the Basement Tapes era that have, you know, snatches of popular songs or a grocery list or a reminder to go buy something or something he heard on the radio. And that I think that continues. And writers who've worked with him, Larry Charles mentions the box, the legendary box, which is filled with scraps of paper and hotel stationery and napkins and bits of whatever. So, and how does that work? And he famously said to, I guess famous if you're really obsessed with the work of Dylan, to Joni Mitchell, the box wrote that song. And I think he sloughs that off a little bit, but I think there's that mix of that. So that notion of, okay, there's the box, what's going into the box? What are the moving parts there? And can you find those? And there's just, once you start diving in, there's just so much there. And finding, you know, for me, going through that and just being meticulous, taking notes, being willing to take notes on things that seem improbable. One thing, it took probably about 5 years in the works. I'd noticed an odd line in a book that came up in Google, but it was in snippet view. And you can only, in snippet view in Google Books, you can only see a small piece of the phrase in context. And so you don't have the whole book. And it was one I'd found, and it was like, oh, that's peculiar, but it's not enough to hang anything on. But I put it on a note card and put it away. And then what had drawn me to it is that the guy who written the book that this turned up in happened to be named Zimmerman. I was like, oh, that's a little weird. And it was just enough for me to put on a notebook, a note, and have it there. And then years later, I came back to say, oh, let me take another look at that. And I went and found the book that it was. And I noticed the phrase that I had found was certainly there, and it did match up. And it was pretty weird, but it wasn't enough. But then there was a matching phrase on the facing page of this same book that made it, there's 100%. There's no way these two peculiar phrases would be that way. It's a section in the Sun Pie portion of Chronicles where he's writing about, in my mind's eye, I could see blood splattered and sprayed. He's writing from the point of view of writing about that interaction with Sun Pie in Louisiana. And it turned out to be from a mystery novel called Blood Trance. And probably the only thing that stands out about it is the guy who wrote it. His name is R.D. Zimmerman. And I looked into it to see, well, who's R.D. Zimmerman? Turns out the guy's name is Robert Zimmerman. And he happened to have the luck or fortune of being from the same generation and being named Robert Zimmerman. And I looked into it more, and it turns out this bothered him so much that he changed his name to his initials, R.D. Zimmerman. And then he changed his name yet again when he wasn't writing mystery fiction. We started moving to historical fiction. He became Robert Alexander. So he'd be at the front of the bookshelf as opposed to in the Z's with that.
Yeah,
and
but the notion then he wound up with the same A middle name as Alan, right? Allen Zimmerman. Right.
Well, he's R.D. Zimmerman. So
right, he went to Alexander. So he actually got closer, yeah, he did, yeah. Right?
and it turns out this guy has been haunted by Bob Dylan fans for years. He used to be listed, and he happened to live in Minnesota for that. So he wrote this great short piece for one of the Minneapolis weekly, an alt weekly there, where they collected all just poison pen letters about Minneapolis. And he had his poison pen letter about drunken Bob Dylan fans from Norway waking him up at 3 a.m. and thinking that, and he thinks they're talking about his book, and it's just another Bob Dylan fan. And they ask him about his middle name. It's D for Dingwall. Dingwall, what time of name? And he doesn't like Bob Dylan, and he writes this whole piece about how he calls him the dreaded him and the other. And it's almost like an Edgar Allan Poe story. Where he goes to the bookstore in his own neighborhood where he's lived for 20 years and gives him his credit card, and they make a Joan Baez joke, as opposed to recognizing that they sell his books and have done book signings with him there. So that the notion that Bob Dylan was playing with that guy in a way that, I don't know, who does he expect that is going to ever notice or recognize that? And the notion that it doesn't seem believable. Like when you say that to someone, that story doesn't make sense. That story sounds fantastic, but it's far too peculiar in terms of language. And then you can see it spread out throughout. And then you can see Dylan doing things like where he did that interview with Michael Gilmore for Rolling Stone, where he brought Sonny Barger's book, Hell's Angels. Right. And because he mentions another guy named Bobby Zimmerman who died in a motorcycle crash. And he draws that, and he's making all these like things about the Zimmerman. So there's another hidden Zimmerman. And he points out that this book is written by, what does it say on the cover? It's Keith and Kent Zimmerman. So he's got those pieces
talks about that concept of transfiguration, and that is the explainer of all explainers in terms of how not just creativity works, but all existence, essentially, that nothing dies, everything's connected.
And that he's playing with that, and that he would be doing that, and with the notion that for what purpose is that serving there, and who's the audience for that? I'm assuming if I found it, I'm part of the audience for that. And I think it does change how you have to look at this material, because it runs so deeply through that stuff. Since I mark it around the beginning of Time Out of Mind is when I really first see him start to work in these methods much, much more elaborately than we might've seen earlier.
And just again, on the methods, right? On the methods. Mm-hmm. So you're imagining, for whatever reason, he's attracted to a cluster of books. He's attracted to the Zimmerman trilogy, right? Yeah. He's attracted to, obviously, Richard Thomas has written extensively about the translations of Ovid and how Dylan is transposing, transfiguring, or translating from the translation of Ovid into his lyrics. And he sort of hangs out with this material, he plays with the material, and then it becomes the material. Some of it makes it onto the stage, and then there are subtle twists. Certainly musically, he's playing a lot more than lyrically, I think. Once he gets to the stage, I think the general body of text remains more or less the same. Is that right? Particularly on the later songs, if you talk about the songs from the, you know, Time Out of Mind and later, which does make up the bulk of his set list, I think. Does the general body of text stay the same?
It changes. There are changes. Sometimes they're just, I think, more in the moment, but there's some that are more deliberate. One of the Time Out of Mind songs in later versions, he starts incorporating like some Johnny and Jack lyrics. So there's ones where there's a different version of it. He used a different version of this verse. He played with... there's one song that's got a whole lot of stuff from Tennessee Williams in it and some other components, and where the verses are different almost nightly, and people would track them. So there is some play with that. There's some even with some of the Rough and Rowdy Ways songs, mm-hmm. he's come up with new bits, new components that are being incorporated. And even sometimes the older stuff, if you go to bobdylan.com, a verse may disappear from the website. So those songs, I think, are always in flux. And we've got the different versions from performance versus what's written versus what's published are going to be in the books of lyrics for that. I think trying to piece together, well, what are those elements? You talk about the art of memory in your book, and how is he building a mind palace, and what are those processes like? And because I don't think he has a photographic memory, but I think the notion that he works on memory is there. I mean, just to remember the songs and that notion of the need for memory to be a troubadour who can play hundreds of songs, mm-hmm. even if you might have some cue sheets on there, he's got that. And I think there's that notion that he works on that. And so what is that like? How does that impact? How is he pulling those pieces together? Where does that alchemy come from? That type of magic. You wrote about the subtle difference between fakery and the art of memory. Mm-hmm. For that, and I was really thinking about you, that notion of, you know, how do you apply those pieces, and people who can develop those memory skills. I worked with a woman who had just trained herself where she could. We trained together, we trained classes together, and we'd have 40 people come into the classroom, and she could memorize all of their names. Yeah. By going down and just do that, and something about them, and just do it seamlessly, which is with practice and skills and application, you can do those pieces. And I don't have that ability. I store information in different ways. I take notes. I read really slowly. Mm-hmm. I take some time to think about things. And that notion of the fakery and the art of memory, there's I haven't seen anybody mention it. I mentioned in a piece I wrote for the New Haven Review that came out in 2010, that Dylan mentions a book called Secrets of Mind Power by Harry Lorraine. And he's talking about the new morning sessions and trying to figure out what Bob Johnston is saying to him, because it's so cryptic. He has no clue what Bob's on to. And he writes, and I would have to take one of them mind reading courses to know what Johnston meant by saying what he just said. And then he goes on, I'd brought a book, Secret of Mind Power by Harry Lorraine, to the studio and had left it laying on one of the couches. I thought that the book might help me to continue freeze framing my image, help me in learning how to suggest only shadows of my possible self, which is an interesting thing. So why is he mentioning that book? And it's a more of a how to remember type book. Harry Lorraine is still around. He's 95 years old. Besides being that's books about being a memory expert. And he used to go on the Tonight Show and he'd memorize everybody's name in the studio, and Carson would flip out because he'd marketed it. He has books and used to have infomercials. But besides his work as a memory expert, he's also a magician. He's a noted card magician, written and performed for decades. And that notion that it's not a mind reading course, which Dylan is talking about, it's a more of a memory training course. A mind reading course would be fakery, because it's how do you do that? How do you present mind mm-hmm. reading effects? So I think about that notion between magic and the art of memory and the application of those mind power tricks to learn that. And when I took a look through Harry Lorraine's book, there's actually a section where he teaches you how to like his strategies for memorizing names. And he gives a list of about a dozen different names and how he would remember Stapleton. You know, you see so many staples that they weigh a ton. You can remember Stapleton.
Sure, and, of course.
And one of the ones he gives there happens to be Zimmerman. Picture a man cooking or simmering in a large pot. Simmer, man, Zimmerman. Yeah. So, and now that, you could throw that away as just an offhand oddball coincidence, and it very likely could be, but this is also the guy that brought the book with Sonny Barger and the Zimmermans to that interview and hid the other Zimmerman there. So I think that notion of magic that is performance that does involve some fakery versus the alchemic type of magic that you might see with Harry Smith is going to put the songs in order on the anthology of American folk music with the notion of it's going to change the world and or whatever that's going to be. That's an artistic magic for that.
And
too.
That library certainly makes its way into the Bob Dylan Center, right? So the Harry Smith piece, which Dylan, you know, has protested, I think, to Greil Marcus's face with a tongue in cheek that, you know, everybody's making too much of this whole business about the anthology of American folk music, where on the other hand, that's in the library. I mean, that's in the heart of the library. And of course, the one of the many, for me, pun intended, I guess, memorable scenes from Chronicles is this incredible description of the New York Public Library.
Right.
And Dylan entering the Memory Palace and choosing the strangest things to explore. Essentially, he wants the microfilm. He wants the microfiche of newspapers from the Civil War era. And then makes the claim that everything he ever wrote derives from that America on the cross, again, Transfiguration, right? That it all comes from this partially invented, somewhat invented, heard someone else had done it, thought about it 45 years later or 60 years later, who knows what, and came up with it. But it's not clear where the myth begins and the joke ends, right? It's just not clear.
And I think that's what keeps it interesting. That section of Chronicles is fascinating. And then when you dive into it and start to break it down, those pieces that he's talking about finding on microfilm and a lot of the really specific facts, you can track to a book called, it's a textbook, it's called Daily Life in Civil War America. And there's all these components. There's no doubt he's going through that and he's using that to flesh that out. So instead of actually going to the library again and digging it up, if he ever did. But I think that notion of reading deeply into those components. Another thing in Chronicles that's along those lines is he's talking about those types of songs that are on the Anthology of American Folk Music, or the disaster songs, the assassination songs, that they're just as live to him as the current events, that it's all one plane of time for that. And the sinking of Bismarck, whatever it's going to be, it's all in one place. And it's, those Civil War stories are just as alive to him. So how big do you make that place? And he's been, and it goes all over the place. I mean, there's where he's going to sit and go through, you know, modern translation of the Canterbury Tales, or he's going through Ovid, or the first time I saw him using poetry of Juvenal is one of the reasons I contacted Richard Thomas years ago. Mm-hmm. Was in an interview. He did an interview and he started writing about seeing sideshows in Minnesota when he was a kid. And the characters he's using to describe the sideshow acts that he saw are directly out of a really specific translation of Juvenal satires. And it turns out Richard Thomas knew the woman, Susanna Braun, who had done that translation. And I got in contact with her as well. And you know, she was a Dylan fan. So you know, that, and then he moves to, so that's, he's doing that in an interview. Who's that? Who's supposed to notice that? And what's the plays that is going on there? And that he's got this work where he's going to do that in, not only in the songs, not only in Chronicles, not only in the film script, but in the interviews, and then moving that into the paintings. For that one, I, in terms of what is he thinking and how does he get there, and what are the things that he's reading that drew me? Like, there's a, really became interested in Dylan's interest in sideshow, because he's got all these different pieces of American entertainment, the notion, all the stuff about the minstrelsy and thinking about those components. I think the sideshow stuff plays into that. And then I noticed there's a book called Secrets of the Sideshows by Joe Nickel. Page like three or four, he's bringing up Juvenal and Bread and Circuses, and it's a really, and he's got, you know, here's it's right there in the first few pages. So was he reading this book, and did that notion of, oh, characters from here are sideshow characters, Juvenal, and let me do that? And is he playing that, and he's using this translation? And then it's a couple of years later where Juvenal comes up in lyrics on Tempest, and then later on Rough and Rowdy Ways, where he's moved to a different translation. And so you've got, I think it's likely he was reading those books, and so take the time and read them, and then you can find other parallels. And one of the things I thought was really interesting in the script for Masked and Anonymous is it's written just as Chronicles is, with bits and pieces from all over the place, but it's made into film dialogue, made into dialogue for the characters. And there's another book on Sideshow called In Search of the Monkey Girl, which is it's a book of photographs. It's a photography book, but the photos have captions. And there's some essays by Spalding Gray. And there's sections of dialogue in the film that come from Spalding Gray's essay, that come from the captions of the photos. There's stories that are rewritten. So it's, how is he reframing those components, and how are they building
that book itself? That he's reframing components from that book that, you know, where I'm looking at you on the Zoom screen. So I saw the cover of the book. The title of the book again is In Search of the Monkey Girl, Photographs and Notes by Randall Levinson, Stories by Spalding Gray. And you're saying that you've just got a sprinkling of pieces of that text, of those captions of the photos in the screenplay for Masked and Anonymous.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it's so specific, and there's so many of them, and how he's crafting their stories, and how do they show up? Jeff Bridges' character, Tom Friend, has a section that's it's actually a deleted scene that you can find on the DVD, where he talks about growing up, and it's all one person's story here. Or there's a line that Edmund says, Mickey Rourke's character, we're not a bunch of strong men at the flea market. And it's right out of the Spalding Gray essay. Yeah. So it's seeing what might jump out at him. And so then take that and expand it across 100 plus books. Some he goes much, much deeper into, some wider. He's got a bunch of titles from them. Sometimes it's just one narrow piece. But it is, and it's trying to parse that, which ones are more likely, which ones is that don't quite make sense, and then taking the time to consider them.
So I'm sitting in my seventh grade classroom. I'm 12, 13 years old. They hand us a copy of As You Like It, and half the book is footnotes, right? Shakespeare got this from here, he got this from here, all the way through, right? All the way through my doctorate, my advisor Bert Wasotsky would say, footnotes are great crutches, but it makes it really hard to dance, right? So, here we are with whether it's Shakespeare or, I don't know, the annotated Dracula, right?
Right.
What's the difference between those examples of a scholar who is annotating, documenting where the references live in the work of a great artist? And why do we find this so shocking in the work of Dylan? Isn't this the way art has always been made?
I hear you. I, for me, that's what I think. It's the way art has always been made. You take pieces of this and that, and you stitch them together, and you see if you can come up with something new, or maybe you can't. And you've got the pieces that may be unconscious and the pieces that you might know. Sometimes it's... And then what is the work that you've got? What is that inventory for that? And what do you do with it? And for me, I liked Love and Theft a great deal before I knew any of those components were there. So then it just makes it more, it adds to the richness of what's going on there. Or that there's peculiar parts in Chronicles that don't quite make sense. And then you can see what he's laying underneath there within. It has to be intent because he tells you sometimes that the example I use is another Mickey Rourke example where he's writing about going to see Mickey Rourke in the movie Homeboy when he's recording Oh Mercy. And he says something about the film when he went to the moon every time he appeared on the screen. And on the same page, he's quoting a line from The First Men in the Moon from H.G. Wells. And so he's like, if you notice that, yes. And very often he'll add a signifier for that. And I don't know that, with Shakespeare that he's doing that. He's saying, if you found this, this is exactly what I intended for that. And some writers go so far down with it. In terms of an annotated book, the annotated Lolita is a fascinating book in terms of how much is going on there and what those notes are to even start to see what he was building there. It's much more than whatever that story is. It's just the thought process of putting those pieces together. And I see some similarities there. With the H.G. Wells, he's not only saying, did you notice this bit from The First Man on the Moon? Yes, I did that intentionally because I mentioned this other line here. But did you notice the other four H.G. Wells novels I did? 3 pages back, 6 pages back, 4 pages ahead. And so is it playing a game of, can you recognize all the times I mention or incorporate H.G. Wells into this and make it seem seamless?
Though he's not saying that. Like when Bruce Springsteen starts his Born to Run autobiography, the first 2 pages is, I'm a huckster, I'm a magician, look at me. Yeah. Do you see my hands? Nothing in my hands. He basically takes all the air out of the balloon by saying, I'm a huckster. I'm the guy who didn't have a driver's license when he wrote Born to Run. I'm a fake, right? And I'm a hack, is what Springsteen's saying. And, I have to say, if you saw his Super Bowl commercial a few years ago, he sure did look like a hack. The wink and a nod that you're describing with H.G. Wells or any of these other references, are you suggesting that part of this is a game to be caught at, or not caught at, to be discovered, that the code is left there as part of the thrill of the composition process to leave these crumbs for somebody to find?
I think there is. And to make a parallel to what you talked about with the beginning of the Springsteen book, I'd argue that Dylan does do that on the first page of Chronicles Volume 1. He lets you know that he's not a reliable narrator and that he's a a bit of a fabulist by using material from other sources. The one that's on the first paragraphs of Chronicles, he starts to incorporate a couple of peculiar bits from Charles Mingus's Beneath the Underdog, where he's talking about a pocket-sized recording studio and leather upholstered booth. And he runs into Jack Dempsey, who says, "You look too light for a heavyweight." And that portion is all out of a passage in Beneath the Underdog, where Mingus is describing a car that it looks too light, it's too light for a heavyweight like Mingus. He's talking about a car, but those other pieces of it's a pocket-sized air conditioner in there, and he's in, it's all right there. And is Dylan aware of that book? Well, he reads the first pieces of it on an episode of Theme Time Radio Hour. It begins with, in other words, "I am three." And that notion that Mingus's book is filled with invention. It's a wonderfully written book, and it's edited in a way. I think there should be a longer version coming out, because he, what ended up being published versus how many hundreds of pages he wrote is mm-hmm. a huge disparity. And a lot of what's in there is it's fascinating reading. And I think he's setting that up. My book is going to be like Mingus's book, if you can pick this up. And he continues that out throughout the book, and does that again and again and again, where it comes off as genuine. I am talking to you about what I am thinking about when there's other things going on beneath. And he does it again and again and again and again with, and sometimes it's just wordplay. It's gamesmanship. I think there's some of that there. I who can tell how much he thought people would start to piece those together. I think certainly with Love and Theft, the title of it is right there.
Right.
And then to notice what those components are, and that it's from such a wide range of places for that, and that how much is still going on within that, and does he change his methods along the way? But I think Chronicles was certainly written along those lines, where he had to be thinking about, you know, all the books on all the tables, and what are the pieces that he's going to use, and how is he going to make that come across as seamless? I mean, that and have that book be so well received with really little awareness of how much was going on. If you go read the original New York Times review of Chronicles Volume 1, it mentions one of the bits from Hemingway, but it didn't notice that there were dozens of others, and that he's building other worlds and labyrinths within that. So I think just, you know, trying to figure out what those components are, gathering all of those, and then breaking it into 1,000 pieces, and then seeing, you know, how do those tie together. And sometimes there's things going on where there's a big loud voice in a paragraph that you can spot. It's a famous voice, but it's covering a smaller voice that is hidden within the same paragraph. I think it's like a magician's trick. Like the big move covers the little move,
right,
where he's doing some of those components. So the just trying to get into the mindset of how are you writing this, and just going about it backwards. Let's go parse this phrase by phrase for the whole book and see how much can be there. I'd put Chronicles down for a while, and I picked it up again last year and went through it and found whole strings of things that I hadn't seen before. Right. And taking the time to consider them, and that the same piece is used in a song on Love and Theft, then it turns up used in a different way in Chronicles Volume 1, or stuff that's in Chronicles that's also used in the Masked and Anonymous script. And how are you playing with that language, having voices speak to each other or marrying them? I really like what he plays with the notion of all the wolves and dogs and wolf dogs in Jack London's short stories mm-hmm. and novels, and describes those traits to the people in his book, to Bob Johnston, to Fred Neil, to Van Ronk, where they're all he's mix and matching and putting those pieces together, where they're all a version of a dog or a wolf dog from Jack London. And that, and just the notion of that kind of play, I think there's a lightness to that that's certainly great fun, and the spirit of adventure that's built into that, that and it seems certainly implausible and improbable, but there's just so many pieces of evidence that it's hard to accept any other. I mean, the notion that some of it is happenstance, sure. I put together a list of lines and bits and phrases from Jack London that he likely used. It's 12 pages long. Might there be one or two or four or five that you might argue, well, that could be just coincidence. There's only so many letters in the English alphabet. You know, I can hear that, but that argument falls flat after, well, here's dozens of them, and here's how he's tying them together, and here's what might be a hidden meaning behind that. Something else that he's talking about that he didn't feel comfortable perhaps talking about on the surface, but he's much more comfortable talking about it via this method.
So let me throw out an idea that just occurred to me while you were talking, as I was using the pieces of the puzzle, the fragments that you were the breadcrumbs that you were leaving intentionally or unintentionally, right? So one of the things might be obvious, but it wasn't obvious to me until I wrote my book, was that for me, Dylan's ultimate message is one of empathy. The question, how does it feel, is to me the question of the age. And I think we are rapidly moving further and further from being able to ask as societies, how does it feel? And I think that's where we're really entering into a period, the dark age, right? If we are unable to ask one another how it feels. So that's why, you know, as Springsteen said, you know, Dylan's the brother you never had. I mean, I never felt like Dylan was a brother type. He would not be a very good older brother, you know, he'd be the rascal. Younger brother was always, you know, getting you in trouble, maybe. But this this ability to draw out in ways that feel strikingly familiar, the actual feeling that I didn't even know I was having, right? And that just thick, emotive, poetic ability to reflect to people deep emotions and in a way that's so human and so lasting. There's that piece. And then there's Dylan, the incredible technician, right? Same album. All these people that you mentioned, I know them, they are quite lame. I had to rearrange their faces and give them all another name. Right now, I don't feel too good. Don't send me no letters. No, not unless they're written to Desolation Row. Now, the emotion is still there. And we know from the Art of Memory that emotion was an important part of the Art of Memory. One of the landscapes where you would place your memory cues was in your childhood home or in whatever place really resonated for you. So Desolation Row isn't just some random street corner. It's the St. James Hotel, right? It is a place where you can actually envelop yourself in your memory of it and put your whole self into it. But the technique, right? So on the one hand, there's Dylan, whose ability as an artist is to make you feel something. And then there's Dylan as the artist, who has this strange combination of gifts where he is building these unusual structures of words and melody, and now much more as we see, right? Images, right? That are technically complex and nuanced and clever and playful. The poles between the emotional and the technical, right? The feel, I guess, the rational and the irrational, perhaps you might even be able to say. Where do you, as a listener, can you do both at once, right? Can you be tracking the ways that these texts or melodies came together at the same time as feeling them? When you listen to Murder Most Foul, right? Maybe not a great example, you know, can you be there with the song when you're listening to the music? Can you be there emotionally and intellectually at the same time? Or have you been gone so deep that you can only hear how it's made?
You know, the notion of empathy, I think, is an important one. And that notion of having that emotional connection that work has there, and the, whatever the methods that he's doing to get that there, it carries over. I think there's, thinking of empathy, he had one interview where he just jokingly said that, like, all of his songs trail off with "good luck, I hope you make it."
Yeah,
you know, that notion that there's that piece, and that's, you know, if you're looking for that notion of something that can touch you on that level and make you feel emotions, you know, that's why you listen to music. Certainly why I listen to music. And the other stuff, that notion of being able to compartmentalize it. You know, I listened to both sides of the Blind Willie McTell 7-inch that came out last year, about an hour ago. And there are different moods on the A side and the B side, the different versions. And can that still trigger those pieces? Yes. And can I can listen to something like a song that's really dense in terms of other material and other things going on to it, multiple threads through it, is like Tweedledee and Tweedledum. Can I put that on and do I have a mind map that triggers and goes ding, 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 ding? Like, I know what all those sources are. And some ways I've conditioned myself to be able to hear those pieces. There's a couple of like YouTube videos I put together where I contrast and compare. There's one I did with bits from New Lost City Ramblers and Mike Seeger recordings and Love and Theft songs. Mm-hmm. So that's telescope down. It's just those bits, but I hear all of those songs. And to expand what my breath is, to know that, that he's combined a line from Bald and Headed End of a Broom, like a folk song, with I Believe I'll Dust My Broom. So like, and I know he was listening to, Mike Seeger singing, boys keep away from the girls, I say, and give them lots of room for it, because then how they'll bang each other dead with a Bald at an end of a broom. He's like, he's thinking of that song and he's playing with those pieces. So sometimes it's going to be really obvious. You're going to recognize the line, the cuckoo is a pretty bird, she warbles as she flies. If you been listening to the anthology of American folk music, you know those. Some of those are gimmies. And I've just kind of expanded my range of what those pieces are for that. So I can do both. I can compartmentalize and just listen to music because I like listening to music. And then I've got the pieces where I'm going to break down and hear it those ways. Like some of those telescope videos I did, there's another one that's all about songs he used from a box set that's on the Bear Family label. That's all early country songs, upbeat country songs from Nashville in the late 40s and early 50s. And he used a whole bunch of them. So now I can hear those bits of songs, and I've got all these other things that spring off from it. So and I think part of it is people have such strong emotional reactions to those pieces. It makes some people very hesitant to look at the things I'm writing, because some of them don't want to know. I don't need to know what the moving parts are. I need to have this experience, and this is the relationship I have with this music. And that's fine. They can do whatever they want, but but I didn't make this stuff up. It's not invention on my part. I try to be fairly prudent and to think about how these things put together. And I think, because building that, what does Bob Dylan's commonplace look like? Then you can get into the idea, well, how did he start to craft these things? And how is he thinking through those? And just give us another way to look at what his process is. And I love the notion of process. I want to see, what does it look like when Andy Warhol and Gerard Malanga are pulling the silk screen down to make those Maryland prints? And I want to say, how do they actually do that? What does it look like when they're making the Brillo boxes? What does those silk screens look like? I want to see all the parts. Like, Warhol has that cow wallpaper, right? And it comes from a book on like animal husbandry and cows. And I went and bought a copy of the book, because I was saying, well, what does the rest of the book look like? I'm that kind of person. And I think there's those components there. Like, one of the most interesting things that Dylan does in Chronicles, that I think makes me think of your book, is when he writes about Mike Seeger. He was such a brilliant musician, musicologist. He speaks of him in the highest terms. The most praise anyone gets, besides maybe Woody Guthrie, is for Mike Seeger in Chronicles. And he uses it, he incorporates into that all of these components that came out of a book called Touchstones, a book of daily meditations for men. It's a book from Hazelden. It's a book from substance abuse recovery. It's a daily book. Here is your thought for the day. Here's your quote for the day. Here's a prayer perhaps for the day. And he's gone through and taken the components of that and structured it around what he's writing about Mike Seeger, where he talks about he never thought of musical performances could be a spiritual experience until he saw Mike Seeger play in The Loft. And he'd have to go back and do all this work to get anywhere near where Mike is going to be. And he's using this language from Touchstones. And I found that probably 10 years ago. And there's sections in there. Actually, I have it on my Kindle. I bookmarked it. So I've got the physical copy. Like, how would you go about doing this? You find one, and then I'll go read the book. Okay, well, there's another one, and there's another one, and there's another line. And you get that notion for how does Bob Dylan's eye scan a page? Sometimes he'll go across a page. So the line starts here, and it goes across there. And sometimes it's the next day. And then that he's using not only this book, but other books like this, these books of like daily meditations, which are different than a Hemingway short story. And how do you categorize those books? This book, I think, is interesting because one of the days, one of the quotes is the Bob Dylan quote, he not busy being born is busy dying. It's so that notion that there is Bob Dylan reading books that mention Bob Dylan. Well, that's a whole section of books. There's books right. that happen to mention him that he uses. That turn up in his work. So is he, you know, how do you, if you are Bob Dylan and you're reading Touchstones for whatever reason, and there's a quote from yourself, how do you, you know, how does that work? And he talks about the notion of music in there. Now, let me bring up my bookmarks here, and there's one passage in here. Let me find my notes. Let me see if I can find the piece here. It uses it a bunch of different times, but it's the November 1st entry, where it begins with, we may have spiritual experiences in our daily lives that we don't think of as spiritual. For many of us, music lifts us from the practical and mundane circumstances of our lives and into communion with the universe. And he's using that piece about, you know, he talks about music washes away from the soul the dust of everyday life. And that you wouldn't know that unless you took the time to parse it and figure out that he's using this book, not only in Chronicles, but it turns up as dialogue for some of the characters in Masked and Anonymous. And I really, you wrote about some of the things that Dylan talks about where he's finding spirituality in the music. He talks, I think it's one of the Robert Hilburn interviews, talks about that. That's what it is. He's thinking about those Stanley Brothers songs, Let Me Die on a Peaceful, Rest on a Peaceful Mountain, those pieces where he's finding spirituality in the music. And I think from about the same time, he's using a book like this to reflect on, or like, who is doing, you know, who's making musical experiences that I think of as spiritual. Mike Seeger was, and how do you, like, as Mike being like the type of person in terms of what is he doing, how is he devoting his life, how is he studying, what is the things he's, you know, what is that work about, and to see that tie through. I wrote, and you wrote about in your book, a long piece about Tweedledee and Tweedledum has got, it functions in one way as an homage to New Lost City Ramblers. And I think right. the title of Modern Times, which is a New Lost City Ramblers record that he quotes from numerous times on Love and Theft, there's these threads of what are the things that are important to him, and that notion of spirituality through the music, and why would you listen to music? And I think he touches on that using this method, where he's talking about it out front, say with Robert Hilburn, and then he's continuing that in the work in using this type of method.
So have you, I'm scanning my mind, you know, Elvis Costello, Paul Simon, Joni Mitchell, Leonard Cohen, right? Who are some of the truly master songwriters of our time? Have you brought the method to any of them? Have you tested the method on any of them?
You know, what's one of the criticisms that I've heard? You could do this with any book and come up with another range of, and it's all poppycock for that. The one I tried was one of Patti Smith's books, just to see, okay. You know, and nothing really turned up there, but I thought, well, what the heck? I'm reading the book anyway. Let's see if there's anyone's. And she just isn't writing like that. I think you do see other ways that people write like that. An example that I talked about with David Kinney, who wrote the book, The Dylanologist.
Yeah. Sure.
And that he wrote about, there was a punk rock band called The Cramps, who I really, really like. And I used to go see all the time. And their catalog is all constructed this way. It's just in those circles, yeah, this is part of a Link Wray song, and this is part of a Chess record song, and this is a lyric from here, and this is a bit of dialogue from film, and it's, but no one ever seems to get upset for that. And they're doing, you know, I found one piece where they're incorporated a line from a book on astral projection and how to force your spirit out of your body, and it, but they've got it in a context of a song where there is hidden Duchamp references and all these obscure records. And I spent a lot of time diving into that. And so in terms of a parallel that I think of, that's one that I really, really like. I think they get dismissed as kitsch a lot, but their music is really dense in terms of material and written in similar ways. Here's a guitar riff from here. Here's a lyrical idea from someplace else. And I think they have some, they overlap with Dylan a bit. They both work with Jim Dickinson. Jim Dickinson plays on Time Out of Mind, and sure, he produced sure. and plays piano on one of them. There's a great version of Redheaded Woman with Jim Dickinson playing and singing and the Cramps backing him up. So I think they're, you know, they've got a lot of the same things that I like. They all love Sun Records, you know, all of that early, you know, for me, my entry points are all through rock and roll. So I, you know, I like Chuck Berry and Bo Diddley and Carl Perkins and, you know, and Elvis and how are those, and those songs are all, Roots of Rock and Roll is all strange and odd and peculiar and weird stories. Those origin stories are all strange. Nick Tosches is a writer who wrote Unsung Heroes of Rock and Roll and another book called Country that are great, filled with profiles and explorations into these types of worlds. He's got a long, long piece on the song Blackjack Davy and country that is, which Dylan has covered, but there's all these other versions. And he talks to one of the Sun artists who'd recorded it. And he's got three different versions of how he came to record those songs. And what are those origin stories? And how do you dive into that? So I think, I don't know that any of, like, I don't know if you see Leonard Cohen or Joni Mitchell or Patti Smith or Bruce Springsteen writing in these methods. One that I did find I thought was really interesting was Ben Harper. Has got a song called Why Must You Always Dress in Black, where he is, I think, consciously trying to do a Dylan by using material from Dylan's own book, by using Chronicles. And the line that he happens to pick, he picks two, and one in particular is about high-heeled shoes that could pierce your heart, and which Dylan writes about at the tail end of one of the chapters, where he spots like a sex worker walking like aimlessly as he's working on the origins to Dark Eyes come out of this story. Mm-hmm. And he uses that line, she had like high heel shoes that could pierce your heart. And it turns out that was something Smokey Robinson said in an interview that is in a book on soul music by Jerry Hershey. And in his telling, in Smokey Robinson's telling, he's literally going to be hit by a shoe that's going to pierce his heart because they're throwing things at the stage. So that Ben Harper takes two lines, one happened to be from Hemingway and the other happened to be from Smokey Robinson. I think, and he didn't know that, I don't think. I think he was saying, hey, this is how Bob Dylan's writing songs. Let me see if I can write a song Bob Dylan style, or at least part of it, and incorporate those bits. Now, like, these phrases from Chronicles are pretty cool. Let me do that. And maybe not realizing that the pieces he picked were from Hemingway and or happened to be from a Smokey Robinson interview. So that one really drew me, because it's just was he trying to write in that strategy, and how do you apply those strategies? How do you take those lessons and make them into music or art that's going to touch people?
I have a sort of a final reflective question for you, which is going to call upon at least one of your three courses of study, the sociology portion. Mm-hmm. If you can crank that up. Did want to share though that I just finished reading the magisterial and almost banned biography of Philip Roth. Mm-hmm. I just finished it yesterday, and I think that two things or three. One, there's a great line from Philip Roth when Dylan won the Nobel Prize, and he said something to the effect of, you know, who's next, Peter, Paul, and Mary? That just a little zinger there. The second, that you're citing Dylan saying that, you know, sort of all of his songs end with the phrase, well, good luck. I really think that's Rothian also. You know, there's something about Roth's humor and darkness, but a colloquial darkness that really resonates. So I'm actually going to do an episode in this season about Roth and Dylan, maybe two, just because I see them as kind of like, you know, Dylan and Cohen, who was obviously older than Dylan, Roth, who was older than Dylan. But the thing that I'm hearing as you describe Dylan, you know, I'm picturing Philip Roth in his home in Warren, Connecticut, surrounded by books, and in the most disciplined life that he lived, right? Reading every day, reading. And then at the end, when he stopped writing, he reread everything. He reread his own books backwards, right? From most recent to the earliest. And he reread all of his Dostoevsky and his Flaubert. He reread everything. And I'm just imagining these, you know, kids, right? Obviously, Philip Roth was probably born in, I don't know, mid-30s, late 30s, Dylan a little later, but these kids, sort of golden age America, quote unquote, readers. I just think it's incredible the way you're describing Dylan as a reader. I mean, almost want to say the most reassuring thing of everything you've said, right, is that this person reads and reads and reads. I mean, the more people read, the better it gets, you know, as far as I'm concerned. And this library, the commonplace as you described it, mm-hmm. the Dylan library. And now with Dylan actually opening up the Dylan library,
yeah.
I just hope we don't miss the message here of what it may all be about in terms of trying to put this stuff in the wrong box, right? Versus the Dylan box, which has in it an element of magic, randomness. There's no high or low culture in there. It's the stuff he's attracted to that someone handed to him, right? So after I've, you know, I can't control myself from waxing, you know, ars poetic here because you've put so much fascinating content out. Where can people find all this, by the way? Where can people find your stuff before I share a final question?
Well, there's a couple of places. My blog has got some of the longer essays that I've written, which is called Goon Talk, GOONTALK, which is carny slang for carny slang, is why I chose that.
We'll put that in notes.
Yeah, and just search for my name, Scott Wormuth, and you'll find my blog, and it's got a bunch of pieces there. I've created a series of Pinterest albums that I think are useful. There's one called A Tempest Commonplace, just moving parts that show up in Tempest, and some other pieces there. There's the Bob Dylan bookshelf that I mentioned, where you can just find those titles and start to dive in. The notion of Dylan as reader, I think that's a great place to start, because it's such a breadth of material. And you can find something that's going to be a good fit for you there. A lot of this work and writing I did maybe about 10 years ago. There's a whole new audience and whole new ways of communicating. So I spend a lot of time on Twitter breaking pieces down. So how can you break stuff down into bite sizes that somebody might be able to grab onto? On Twitter is another place that I've been putting pieces. And my YouTube channel, where I've got a whole series of Dylan-related videos where I take some pieces that you can expand out for a whole lot into just a couple of minutes, or telescope down, so you can at least say, oh, there's something going on there. Or it's a quick way to do compare. So you can certainly get there that way. For me, the notion of Dylan as reader, I think, is huge. I'm glad that resonates with you. For me, having 100 different books that I know that Bob Dylan most likely looked at, and finding the ones that he really spent a lot of time with, you can gain a perspective of how his eye scans a page. If you know you've got the same edition, hey, this one caught his eye, maybe because it's the bottom of the page, it's the very first line of the page. Or did he pick this line from the Sax Drama novel because it's page one and maybe someone easily would find it versus the one that's page 200? Or just how his eyes goes across a page. When you find those examples, it's fascinating in terms of what is he picking up on, what jumps out at him, what phrases go, which writers does he like the most? So, you know, reading through the short stories of Ernest Hemingway, and then recognizing and piecing together all the pieces that jumped out of Bob Dylan. And, you know, it's a course in American literature by a really interesting guy to lead you through it. And so he's put all of that out there. And I think you can spend the time to figure out, how does Bob Dylan read? What's on his bookshelf? What's in his record collection?
It's all sacred text, right? It's all sacred text that he's bringing in. It doesn't matter where it comes from. He's canonizing it all.
So the commonplace and the inventory on one side, and then that, how is he making it into magic and making it into things that touch us and so many people in so many, you know, profound ways, that why is this material so popular and still resonate and touch all of those places? And how do you get there? I mean, there's
my question. That's my sociologist question, right?
Yeah.
So if you can pull yourself up on the pulleys out of the hole that he's in, right?
Yeah.
And come back up and maybe go up. I don't know. We can climb up into Leonard Cohen's Tower of Song and take a look down at the landscape here and ask ourselves, from a sociological perspective, a musicology perspective, you know, Paul Simon's got his legal pad per song, right? He's banging it out line after line, meticulously, like a lawyer writing a brief, you know. Elvis Costello, God knows, I mean, just so wicked smart and clever and you know, such pristine, the ability just to shine these songs. But nobody does this kind of writing quite like Dylan. It has a social, a cultural resonance. At the end of the day, he is this guy walking through the garage sale of culture and picking out the pieces that shine for him or look a little odd or something that he thinks, maybe I can do something with this with it, you know? What is the social message? What is the message, the creative message that, you know, you glean, you've spent a long, rich period of time digging into this stuff? How should we understand the world? How can we understand creativity? How can we understand purpose? Because this is a guy who's been talking about these things for 60 years. What do you glean from his process as a message to the listener, the detective, right? The scholar, the curious person, right? Who is just attracted to this stuff and wants to know how it works and finds out this is how it works. What's it mean?
You know, what does it mean to be, you know, I think about the frailty of the human condition, you know, the amount of time you have on this earth, and what do you do with what you've got there? And how do you make that resonate? I think that's the big piece there. All of those big questions of life were there, like that he chose to devote his time to not only writing this way, but then to bring it out and to tour and to share that. So that notion of someone who works so hard to be able to do this, that this just doesn't come as just brilliantly flows out of them. With some people it does. I don't know that George Jones ever thought this deeply about any of these components, but he can still touch you in those ways. And that music, George Jones's music, can certainly hit you that way. But I don't know if he was much of a reader. I don't know if he had those deeper pieces there. And I think there's this piece is going on there. I think it serves as an inspiration, just the notion of the breadth of human experience that you can touch through his music that reaches out and grabs so many people and figuring out the ways that works. And he certainly has those strategies and how they function. Part of it is, hey, this touches me and this makes me feel these pieces. And how does it get there? And that step in between, and it gives you something to do. John Cohen, I got a chance to talk to about some of the things I had spotted Dylan doing regarding him specifically in Dylan's work. And he asked me, well, why do you do this? Why are you doing this? And I, one of the things I said was, well, it puts me in a position to read things I wouldn't have thought to read, to listen to things I wouldn't have thought to listen to. So how do I, you know, what else are you going to do? That path along the way, it's not a final end desk journey. It's what's happening on the journey. Who are you meeting along the way? What are the things you're doing? How are you using your time? How are you broadening what you think about? How are you challenging yourself regarding those components? There's things I found in Dylan's work that I haven't written about that challenge me. So I've got to pause and go slow and consider, and it gives you a chance to be contemplative on that. And it's all there. And there's just so much of it. That well seems to go on and on and on. The notion that this is endless. You can listen to this and you can dive into this and you can build your life through this. And it's enriching. And it's a way to have a rich life is through reading, the interaction, the people you meet along the way, And I think that's one of the big components there, is that here's a path. How do you make this work for decades? And that it's okay to fail. And it's okay to make mistakes. And it's okay to have records from the 80s that don't resonate with Scott Wormuth and Albuquerque. Like, who cares? He's already moved on to something else.
Until Jeff Rosen recurates them. And then suddenly it becomes the rich era of Dylan's renaissance, right?
But that notion that you can, it's to keep trying. Let's try it in 5 different keys. Let's try it rewriting it a ton of different ways. What are you seeing in Tulsa, or are the piles of drafts? Like, how do you get there, and how do you work to get there, and how do you make that happen? And the work for that. And for me, that's, and when you find something that's maybe that isn't readily obvious, that's built into that work, some of the ways I've been digging up, it's a window into that process, and an enriching one.
You know, the hardest chapter for me to write in my book was the one about teachers, because I felt that Dylan had a litany of teachers that he cites. He talks about his teachers, and yet he doesn't present himself as a teacher. You know, he's the master who refuses to have a disciple. And the joke of the new Dylan, and the strangeness of someone who is so steeped in tradition, so many different kinds of traditions, and refuses to participate in the basic structure of tradition, which is student and teacher. But listening to you and learning from you, I actually think maybe I should have spoken to you when I was writing that chapter, because what I've understood is that maybe this is the teacher who teaches us how to read, who teaches us how to be creative by doing. He says, come to my shop and watch me make this thing, and just sit with me and pay attention if you want. Don't pay attention. You wanna sing like me, you wanna think like me, you wanna be like me, you wanna write like me. Just watch, just listen. I'm not gonna tell you how to do it. I mean, here and there, I'll drop a few hints, right? I might turn this way or the other. I might tell you that you should actually pay attention to the left hand as opposed to the right hand. But basically, you're describing how he has essentially created a kind of secret curriculum that if people are paying attention to it, they actually found a teacher. They actually made a teacher.
And I think we'll see more of that when the new book, Philosophy of Modern Song, right, is on the horizon. And the notion of teachers that, well, Mike Seeger as teacher, John Cohen as teacher, as role models that he holds up. And he's different than them. He certainly thinks about their process and what they do, their preservation of song, the going out in the field and finding, you know, Roscoe Holcomb or Doc Boggs are still around, and you can talk to them, and those are people that he would see. But I think he's got those aspects that he thinks of, like those people who are working in that tradition. And I think that's one of the reasons why we're seeing some of this, is that debt he recognizes to what those people are doing comes out in this work. And they're all teachers. I attended an old time string band workshop with John Cohen at the Santa Fe Folk Festival like 15 years ago, in a tent in a muddy field where he's got his banjo out, and he's there doing that to teach. And I'm able to come back to him a decade later saying, hey, you know what? I was looking at this other guy, you know, that guy you took photos of in 1962, et cetera. Yeah. And look what he's doing, this. And to be able to share some of those lessons back, applying some of those notions that they're doing, the notions of musicology, of song collecting, of thinking through those components of and where are they coming from. So I think we'll see more of that. I can't wait to see what Philosophy of Modern Song brings. It's going to, you know, is it going to be done the same way as some of these works that I've been diving into? Is it going to be something totally different? And what I like is people picking up on and finding things that I wouldn't necessarily have noticed, but noticing, well, since this is the method we know that he's using, what are some of the other things we can find? Like, for instance, Laura Tenchert found, in My Own Version of You, which is a Frankenstein song in ways, he's not quoting Frankenstein, he's quoting the Cliff's notes for Frankenstein, which is wild. And I wouldn't have thought to look for that. But it's right there. About looking for the necessary body parts. And and the whole lines. And so it's the notion that he's using Cliff's notes in his Nobel Prize lecture as well. So is there a level
a student.
Of, or is there a student component, and is he making it more obvious with that? Being, hey, these Cliff's notes, you get this is a way to study literature, or is it becoming trolling after enough time? It's hard to tell, but I think there's that notion of a teacher on his own terms, and you've got to bring your own stuff to the plate to be able to interact with it to get the most out of it. And I mean, you can just listen to those songs and have that in relationship with it and have your own string of memories that it triggers and all your own visuals, because it's open for that. And that's certainly valid and a way to do that. And I listen to it that way too, but there's a whole lot of other things going on there too. And it's deep and it's rich. And I think it's just starting to be tapped. I think there's much, much more going on than some of the things I've noticed.
Well, I want to thank you for sharing your immensely learned, curious, inspiring vision for Dylan with us. I will encouraging friends and colleagues to find your many insights online. And just thank you for the work, right? You talk about Dylan and his work. Let's thank you for your work. This is really a special way to appreciate Dylan. It's a special way to appreciate culture. And, you know, it's a special way to be a co-traveler in some way with a guy who claims to make the path very, very hard to follow. But actually, just by listening and paying attention, it's actually really easy to feel a part of something magnificent. And I think that's one of the doors that you've opened for a lot of us. It's a special way to be a part of the Dylan universe that doesn't require the usual fanatical fandom. It's just about listening, which is so great. And it's active listening too. So you've taught us a lot of lessons, and I appreciate your work and your time. And thank you so much, Scott.
My pleasure. I appreciate the conversation. Thank you.
Absolutely.
This has been episode 4 of season 3 of Bob Dylan, about man and God and law. Thank you to Scott Wormuth for blowing our minds. I invite you to visit mangodlaw.com for more about this podcast, upcoming events, and even an excerpt from the book about man and God and law, The Spiritual Wisdom of Bob Dylan, available now. And speaking of books, we will be dedicating the next 2 episodes of this podcast to comparing and contrasting the work of 2 almost contemporaries who live and loved in their books, in their writing, as writers, Bob Dylan, of course, and the great American novelist, Philip Roth. Look for upcoming episodes wherever you are listening now, and be sure to subscribe and rate the show when you do. It really helps this podcast grow. We are proud to be part of the Pantheon Podcast Network. Visit pantheonpodcast.com for a cornucopia of wonderful podcasts for music lovers. I am your host, Dr. Stephen Daniel Arnoff. Thanks for coming, and see you soon. Fall in love with me.
Say dead, 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 dead. You know I mean it from the bottom of my boogity, boogity, boogity shoe. Boogity, boogity shoe.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more Fantasy Points.